conflicts today destroy social capital, they destroy human capital, and they also aggravate poverty. They make it more likely that wars recur in the future.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, for many years, the research done by Dominic Rohner of the University of Lausanne has focused on the causes of and the ways to resolve conflict. His work seems to get more important, more relevant every day. Disputes over territory, beliefs, natural resources, destroying communities and destroying economies as well. This is clearly the moment to talk to Dominic about his new book, The Peace Formula, which calls out the errors that powerful people are repeatedly making that create or sustain these conflicts, and sets out a different way to prevent and resolve them. He joins me now. Dominic, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Thanks a lot for having me.
I'm delighted that you have this book coming up. But first of all, why? You publish a lot of research into the causes of conflict and also into the ways that we can reduce conflict. So why do you need to write a book as well?
So, you know, academic articles reach mostly an audience of peers, of other scholars. And my goal was to spread the insights of this area of research much more widely to policymakers, to a wider public. And the book is written in a kind of way that can be multi-use. So it's very accessible and non-technical. So it could be a bedside reading, although the topic is obviously a bit gruesome, but it's accessible to everybody. But at the same time, it contains an appendix with a lot of detailed references, so making it also useful for scholars and students of various disciplines.
Is the world becoming more violent at the moment? It often seems that way.
I think in the very long run view, it has been argued that that's not necessarily the case. However, if you look at the post-1945 period, so years since World War II, clearly in the last 5-6 years, we have reached a peak in the number of annual conflicts. And so now in the statistics, we have more than 50 countries around the world, a quarter of countries that are experiencing armed conflict and now for several years. So that's a very tragic low point, something that we haven't seen for decades and decades. So yeah, it's not a good time.
The title of the book, Dominic, The Peace Formula, is it too ambitious to assume that there is any formula for peace?
Of course, there is no exact formula like Pythagoras or something that would guarantee peace, but there is a set of ingredients in the book. I'll talk about work, voice, and warranties. I can say more about that later on, but there are a few basic principles and ingredients that greatly help to reduce the likelihood of armed conflict, as shown in many statistical studies. So it's not a formula in the physical sense, but still, these are ingredients that work.
There is a huge prize to gain. What's happening at the moment to the people who are caught up in conflict, and what's going to continue to happen to them if we do not find this formula?
In the book, I also talk about the very tragic short and long run consequences of being trapped in war. So wars lead to a series of what I call war traps, where basically wars do not only kill people, but they also plant the bad seeds for future conflict. So we have a piece together with Matthias Tönig on this, for example, and in the book I also talk about it at length, where basically what happens is that conflicts today destroy social capital, they destroy human capital, and they also aggravate poverty. They make it more likely that wars recur in the future. And so wars have very bad long-run consequences that go way beyond the last shot that has been fired.
So clearly you're not the first person to go looking for this formula. I note that you have some harsh criticism for those who you would consider have been looking for it in the wrong places. First criticism is for those who try to keep the peace by what you call the better the devil we know strategy. What's an example of this?
In the book, I discuss at length several empirical studies by other people. So the book is not just about my work, but I cover big parts of the literature by many, many people. And so I discuss at length several empirical studies of the impact of great powers supporting corrupt regimes with an appalling track record of violating human rights. One article I discuss at length, for example, is called Paying Them to Hate Us. And us is spelled with capital letters referring to the U.S., Paying Them to Hate U.S. And so this piece, for example, contains very strong statistical evidence that the U.S. military aid over the last decades has in many instances actually not bought long-run stability, but has, if anything, fueled corruption and fostered anti-American resentment and terrorism. And so, yeah, often actually this can backfire.
So your objection to the better the devil you know strategy, it's not primarily that it's immoral.
My objection is twofold. So it's both morally wrong to support bad regimes that repress their citizens, but on top of that, it tends to backfire in the long run. Yeah, it goes beyond some moral statement. It's also in terms of the consequences it has.
What is the process by which it does backfire? How do these strategies unravel?
There are actually several studies beyond the one that I mentioned. And what they found is that often military support payments may, especially if it's a corrupt government, be channeled to pro-government groups that are close to the regime, which would aggravate local grievances, lead to more corruption, and also weakening democratic institutions and governance. And so people are just upset because Western powers play a cynical and phony role to preach democracy, but then support bad regimes. And they see that in their home country, the money would be appropriated by some groups and not benefit the population at large. It's through the stirring up of local grievances that basically this anti-American sentiment can take hold after this US military aid.
Another strategy that you call out is the policy of sending cash to try and curb conflict. But you've already pointed out that war impoverishes people. So what's wrong with this approach?
I'm not against sending cash, but it's true that in the literature, it has been found by various studies that cash transfers are a mixed bag when it comes to conflict. So some studies have actually found that there can, in some cases, be a conflict-reducing effect of some welfare programs, especially in some cases of conditional cash transfers. But in others, for example, there's a famous study with U.S. food aid, there has been, if anything, an increase in conflict that has been found. And we have a recent paper that has been published roughly 2 months ago, I think, in the AER Insights together with Patrick Premont. And in this paper, we look at cash transfers in Niger. And what we find there is that actually these cash transfers have attracted raids by international terrorist groups like Boko Haram from neighboring Nigeria. And so, yeah, there are risks. But what's important to note is that that doesn't mean that overall cash transfers are bad. So, for example, in this program in Niger, my co-author Patrick, he has written a series of papers, and many of them find that in terms of poverty eradication and other dimensions, the program is doing spectacularly well. So in some sense, it's surely a very good idea to have a program like that, but the message is not to curb it, but rather to add security guarantees.
You favor investing in peace rather than buying peace. What's the difference on the ground?
One thing that works really well are things like investment in school construction, better health systems, labor market policies, things that lead to productivity gains that empower people. And so people who have opportunities, they have a higher opportunity cost of war. So you and me, we prefer to sit in our cozy office and have a cup of tea rather than to run around with a Kalashnikov. And many other people are like us. They will only be recruitable by rebel entrepreneurs if they are out of options. If they have options to make a living in a peaceful way, biggest part of people will prefer that. And so the idea being that if you increase productivity, education, health, and these factors that make people able to earn a good living, you basically cut the potential for warlords and rebel recruiters. Or to put it a bit more bluntly, you can steal physical capital, but you cannot steal human capital.
So given these problems, should we be giving up on aid in conflict situations?
Well, definitely not, because overall, of course, aid to the extent that it makes a place richer would also entail the potential for investment, for higher productivity, for more opportunities outside fighting. And so it's not about cutting aid. It's more about adding protection to aid. So rather than stopping an aid program, what would be important would be to recognize that there is a risk that some armed groups may attack a place. So you want more security, for example, through UN peacekeeping troops.
The third misconception that you point out is the strategy of trying to win hearts and minds. What's wrong in a conflict situation with a charm offensive?
Well, there have been a series of studies by Eli Behrmann, for example, and Coulters. And what they find is that it's not a bad idea to try to win hearts and minds, but security should come first. So to have security for you and your family is a really basic human need. The moment you are unsafe, your kids are at risk, you care less about charm offensive and hearts and minds. So you need to first establish security for everybody. And then once this is done, then the next step in the hierarchy of needs would then be to address other needs.
Often in conflict situations, though, especially civil conflicts, I would imagine one side or the other would argue that what they are doing is providing security for people against violence, and that's why there is the conflict in the first place. Who in your mind is providing this security? How do they provide it without getting caught up in the war?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So I think it's a question of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. If you create some kind of ad hoc coalition that's not very broad-based of a few countries, then you end up exactly with this problem that you describe. That's why it's so important to have a general, universal force. And so UN peacekeeping troops, for example, would in many cases be a big part of the solution. So there is amazing work by Lisa Hultman from Uppsala and Coulters. And in the book, I talk a lot about that as well. And what they find is that UN peacekeeping troops have overall really good effects, actually, in terms of protecting civilians, but also in some cases, more long-run effects.
Let's have a look at the peace formula. Your formula, you mentioned it before, is voice, work, and warranties. This voice, is it the same thing as democracy, or a voice of the people?
Yes, exactly. So when I talk about voice, what I have in mind is democracy.
Why would anyone who's just won a conflict or wants to win a conflict, what incentive do they have to make themselves vulnerable by being more democratic? That gives a voice to their enemies.
Well, let me tell you a story to illustrate this.
Okay.
Switzerland. So Switzerland has been plagued for a whole medieval ages by conflicts between Protestant and Catholic cantons. And so it has been a terrible fighting for centuries. And then there was the newest war. The newest war was in 1847, the so-called Sonderbundskrieg, where the Catholic cantons wanted to split from the rest of the country and create their own special alliance. The Protestant forces were against. There was a war, short war, the Protestants won. And then they had the usual choice. The default option in medieval times was to squash, torture, kill the loser of the war. But the Protestants, they had the visionary idea of saying, well, rather than being nasty with the loser, actually, let's reach out to them. Let's create a new power-sharing constitution in Switzerland. And that was the new constitution of 1848 and the creation of modern Switzerland. This had like a bicameral parliament. It has direct democracy, where we have several times a year, maybe four times a year, votes on initiatives, referenda at the polls. It has a proportional representation. And for many of these political instruments, you need a double majority for changes in the constitutions. And given that the Catholic cantons are smaller, you end up with a situation where the losers of the war had more power than the winners. So the winners were so generous to give very strong veto rights to the losing small Catholic cantons that could block everything in the bicameral system with double majority. And that's really remarkable and has led to a lot of stability. Well, first first-time peace for centuries and thereafter, and with coalition governments where different parts of the country are represented in a grand coalition. And this generosity has paid off. The country went from being one of the poorest and most conflicted countries in Europe to one of the richest and most peaceful. So that would illustrate why it's a good idea to bet on democracy.
But it relies very much on the generosity, the far-sightedness of whoever ends up in power to put this in place.
Yes, yes. So it's true that there are critical junctures. I think of Nelson Mandela, for example. Mm-hmm. The generosity of Nelson Mandela and his vision at the critical juncture has done so much good to the country, right? There are critical junctures where, for some historical chance or bad luck or this person in charge versus this other person in charge can make a big difference for many decades.
Okay, so part two of the peace formula, that's work. And we know that conflict destroys jobs, it destroys education, so the chance of good quality work for many young people, and therefore joining a militia becomes much more attractive. How can we make work in these situations more attractive than joining an army?
One is really for people to be able to get good work. So One is stepping up education. So there is evidence that building schools is something that reduces conflict. So we have a newly published paper on the impact of antiretroviral treatment against HIV and how having better access to these medical drugs would have a big impact in reducing social violence. So these kind of things, they matter a lot because people have opportunities in life, in a career. And so this range of public policies, good institutions, as well as education, health investments, also some job programs. So there has been work by Blattmann and Annan, for example, or there has been work by Thiemo Fetzer as well, that would show that also some kind of jobs and training programs would make a big difference. And often it's training combined with some cash assets. So if you want to start a farm, well, you need to learn something about farming and you need some startup capital. Mm-hmm. And these things can work remarkably well to get people off the street and off the radar of warlord recruiters.
And the third part is what you call warranties, increasing state capacity, a guarantee from the state. That's a long, hard job, and it outlasts most political careers, especially in an unstable state. What sort of people or organizations can we depend on to deliver this? What sort of people or organizations are capable of delivering it?
Again, I think this calls for the UN peacekeepers. So there's all this evidence I talk about in the book that the UN blue helmets make a big difference. And again, it's the most global and legitimate organization to do that. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're short on volunteers. So clearly, some countries are miserly in funding them. And if they could recruit enough troops, they would be able to do much more. So that's a bit of the limit of what they can do. But there are several studies that have shown that their presence makes a huge difference, actually.
Well, these are difficult, complicated questions, but it's clear from what you're writing in the book that many of the political approaches at the moment to solving conflict or reducing conflict, well, they don't seem to be supported by the evidence. Thank you very much for writing the book, pulling all this together, Dominic, and talking about it to me today.
Thanks so much for your time, Tim.
Dominic's book is called The Peace Formula, Voice, Work and Warranties, Not Violence. It is published by Cambridge University Press. This has been a Vox Tech Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're liking Vox Tech Talks, then please rate us, leave a review, and then other people who would appreciate what we have to say, well, they can find us as well.